to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we'll be hearing about new thinking in urban design. I myself am kind of a Grinch about cities, but I've always embraced possibilities, which is why I love this passage from my man William Morris, which I believe was written in the late 1880s. And he wrote elsewhere that the vitality of the natural world outside of cities should flow into cities. There shouldn't be such a break between the greenery and the beginning of the bricks and mortar and cement and steel. And here he writes, "Decorative, noble, popular art will make our streets as beautiful as the woods, as elevating as mountainsides. It will be a pleasure and a rest, not a weight upon the spirits, to come from the open country into a town. Every man's house will be fair and decent, soothing to his mind and helpful to his work. All the works of man that we live amongst and handle will be in harmony with nature, will be reasonable and beautiful." So that was his idea of design in homes, in communities, in cities. Amen. Now, last Sunday I read an article in the New York Times about the new, rather new, I think it's a year old now, Center for Urban Science and Progress at New York University. Progress could mean a lot of different things to different people. In any event, I thought at first that this center would be focused on furthering the next stage of what's called the New Urbanism movement, which is now about 30 years old. But no, the Center for Urban Science and Progress at NYU is focused on solving those urban problems that lend themselves to quantification and technological responses. Specifically, it's focused on what's become known as smart city technology. And the center's director is Stephen Koonin, who's a New York native, and he was recently the Undersecretary for Science in the Department of Energy. So one of the big focuses is on reducing energy usage. Nothing wrong with that. It goes on to explain that smart technology involves goals that are big gains in efficiency and quality of life by using digital technology to better manage traffic and curb the consumption of water and electricity, for example. And that cities such as Stockholm and Singapore are deeply into smart city projects. And here's the kicker. The market looms as a big, lucrative business for technology companies. So city governments, as Dr. Koonin points out, have been collecting data for years trying to become more efficient. But what's different today, he says, is that digital technologies, sensors, wireless communication, storage, and clever software algorithms are advancing so rapidly that it's becoming impossible to see and measure activities in an urban environment. It's becoming possible to measure them as never before. He says, we can build an observatory, quote, we can build an observatory to be able to see the pulse of the city in detail and as a whole, unquote. Oh, no, an opticon. But he quickly knows what the reader's thinking here and jumps in and says, no, we're not involved in any surveillance, just science. So he says the collected data will be the raw material for modeling outcomes, say the steps required to reduce electricity consumption in a high-rise office building or an individual apartment building. And these modeled predictions then can be used to guide policy or inform citizens. He says, I'd like to create the game SimCity for real by building these complex computer simulations. So one project is to employ wireless sensors, tiny ones outside of windows, noise meters on traffic lights and street corners. And so they would then be able to measure the street-level noise readings and on up into the people who live a few floors above the street. And another project on the drawing board, he says, is technology for capturing thermal images of buildings across much of the city. as a starting point for research on energy use. And then there was a team that tackled this problem of illegal conversions, where landlords are jamming a lot of people into apartments that aren't zoned for that many people and creating hazardous conditions. So when they combined data from 19 agencies, including late tax payments, repair permits, foreclosure records, and ages of the buildings, then they were able to figure out where to send New York City's 200 building inspectors. Because previously, when they would go out to find these fire hazards and high-risk conditions, they would correctly identify a building like that only 13% of the time. But now, when they're sent out, they identify a hazardous situation 70% of the time. So that's very interesting. And in the end, he says, in many smart city projects, quote, the single biggest impact is transparency and the effect of measurement and communicating of the data. Oh, actually, that's someone else's quote. But anyway, you get the point. Communicating the data. And then they admit communicating with people effectively, communicating the data effectively, experts say, requires skills beyond technology. So in the end, Dr. Coonan says the approach we're taking here is from sensors to sociologists. This has got to be science with a social dimension. Well, not to disparage this work at all, because it's very important to cut energy use. But there are a couple things that come to mind. One, there doesn't seem to be a big impulse to green cities. And as I mentioned earlier on this program, one study of people living in public housing projects in Chicago found that living near green open spaces or trees has been found to decrease the incidence in urban residents of depression, anxiety, and a range of diseases such as asthma, diabetes, intestinal problems, and back and neck pains. So, you know, there have been nonprofits in some cities who've gotten the permission of the city to cut a hole in the concrete along the little strip along the curb and plant trees. And what a difference that makes to all the streets. What a difference. And it also cleans the air. And I heard on NPR just the other day how, with the climate change and the rising temperatures, cities are going to be much hotter than the surrounding countryside. It's going to be a big challenge to cool cities, preferably using smart design and just ramping up the air conditioning. And the other thing I think about, if there's a center that's going to address urban progress, would be all the social alienation in cities, which is at the root of so many problems. It's closely correlated with a lot of diseases, with learning problems in children, with very aggressive, violent, antisocial acting out with or without guns. And it seems that it's not just a matter of how to communicate data to people, but if you're really going to revitalize the cities in every way, you need to find a way to revitalize the eco-social reality of people in the neighborhoods, in the apartment buildings, on the various blocks. I'm sure they have a lot to say about issues related to these quantifiable tasks that this center is taking on. So I'm happy to say that the guest we're going to hear from today works with a much broader and deeper sense of what a truly smart city might be. And again, not setting aside the quantifiable information I just talked about, but just broadening it, opening it up to a bigger vision. My guest today is Nan Ellen. She's professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah. She holds a PhD in urban planning from Columbia University and was a Fulbright scholar in France. Her books include Postmodern Urbanism, Architecture of Fear, Integral Urbanism, and PHX: 21st Century City, and that's co-authored with Edward Booth Clibborne. Her new book we're going to be hearing about is Good Urbanism, which describes a paradigm shift in urbanism beyond sustainability to thriving and prosperity. Her work has been translated into many languages, and she spearheaded Canalscape in Phoenix, Arizona, to leverage the vast network of canals in the Phoenix region, which interestingly were originally built by Native American people, by creating vital urban hubs where these canals meet major streets. At the University of Utah, Nan Ellen heads the Salt Lake City Workshop, which bridges the usual town-gown split by bringing together the university with the city government of Salt Lake City and community partners to envision possibilities and to catalyze positive transformation. Nan Ellen, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book, Good Urbanism, especially following last week's guest, Michael Braungart, who made the case that we should not settle for design of products, buildings, communities that are merely sustainable, but rather we should design so as to enhance the health of the ecosystem in which we live and design so as to thrive. All the creatures thrive in that area. And I think you have the same end in mind when you use the term prosper, as in the subtitle of Good Urbanism, which is Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. So what are the connotations of prosper that you have in mind with that?
When I use the word prosper, I mean, or when I use the word prosperity, I mean prosperity for all people. So often we use the word prosperity as an economic prosperity only, but in this sense, it's prosperity in every sense of the word. In fact, a lot of people are using the word thrivability instead of prosperity. Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit of an awkward word, but prosperity is a word that needs to be clarified since it's typically used with regards to economic prosperity. And here we mean it with regards to every kind of prosperity.
And I love the thesis that you introduced at the beginning of the book. How can we make places lovable as well as livable?
That's right.
Would you say something about that and how this vision differs from the goal, and then we'll get into how it differs from the practice of the way urban design or redesign is usually approached?
Yeah, as an urbanist, it occurred to me that people speak with great emotion about places. They say, I love that city. I love that neighborhood. I love that house. And conversely, they say, I hate that city, I hate that neighborhood, I hate that house. And so I started thinking, what is it that makes people proclaim their love for a place? And I realized that when we say we love a place, it's because we feel connected when we're there. We might feel connected with ourselves, with others, with nature, with the past, with the future, maybe with a higher being. And when we say we hate a place, it's because we feel disconnected when we're there. So as an urbanist, I thought I need to figure out how to create places that are lovable as well as livable, which means how can I we create places that foster these connections? And that's what this book, Good Urbanism, is about.
And then you talk about the Tao of urbanism. That's very interesting as well. What's that?
The Tao of urbanism is really, well, the Tao is the path. And it's really evoking this idea that there's a larger thing, that it's not the kind of scientific method you were speaking about earlier, which is important, as you recognized, but that that method should be embedded in a larger approach. And the Tao of urbanism says we need to follow a path, and this path should be an integrated approach. It should be a contextual approach, and it should not assume that or desire a clean slate. And so much of the urbanism over the last 50 to 80 years wanted a tabula rasa, a clean slate on which to build. And the Tao recognizes all of the intrinsic gifts of a place and of an individual and of a community. And that's what this approach attempts to do.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of a tabula rasa, I like to say it's a tabula plena, a full slate.
Yeah. Well, that reminded me, speaking of urban renewal, where they were just level blocks and they sat there for decades. Are you familiar with Mindy Fullilove's work about Pittsburgh, the urban renewal there?
Yeah, we actually both have pieces in the same book called What We See.
Uh-huh.
That is about advancing the observations of Jane Jacobs.
Yeah, well, she was on the program last summer,
uh-huh.
and she was talking about the informal connections that arose in the old neighborhood, which was considered too run down.
Right.
And the backyard gardens, and people would just trade vegetables, and the older people who would sit on the street would keep an eye out on the teenagers, and everything was connected in mm-hmm. so many subtle ways. And then, of course, when that's leveled and the projects go up, you just lose all that. But that didn't figure at all, as you say, in this tabula rasa kind of thinking about fixing problems in urban areas. So what you came up with then are six steps to achieving this goal of thriving and prospering. And what are those?
Right. So the six steps, and I call this a path, and it is the path toward prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a linear path. It's a spiral path. And that's because you might spiral down a little bit and then spiral back up. And each step contains the steps previous to it. So the first step is the step that identifies the assets that are already there, and I call this prospecting. We're prospecting for the gold, the gems that are already in a place. And this is the most important step, and it's the most often skipped, and maybe I can describe later why it's so important. The next step after we identify these gems that might be hidden is we polish them. That's basically assembling all of these gems or gifts and connecting the dots between them. And then we very naturally move from that step two of polishing to step three, which is proposing. And proposing is taking all of these gifts, and once you find what's there, you can see where there's energy and where it's lacking, and you can perform what many people are now calling urban acupuncture. And urban acupuncture assumes that just as we have energy meridians in our bodies, we also have natural energy meridians in our cities. Mm-hmm. And so this approach would open up blockages on any meridians that could be blocked and liberate the chi or the life energy so that cities and communities can be in flow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we propose. And then we very quickly, the last three steps are just promote, where you communicate the concept. You prototype it, you test it, and you refine it. And then the last step is present. You present it to communities. So you basically start with gifts, prospecting, looking for the gifts that are already there, and you end with a gift, a present. It's an economy of gifts, ultimately, mm-hmm. this spiral.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested in looking at your chart that you can sometimes circle back. You know, if you realize you needed to do some more work at a previous step.
Absolutely,
which
yep.
I think is important. Mm-hmm. I mean, having been involved in so many grassroots projects where it wasn't clear how to go back without losing the forward momentum, and often people didn't go back to correct what should have been corrected early on.
Mm-hmm.
So also just the idea that after everyone brainstorms and then you sort of polish or discuss these brainstorming ideas and then come to some proposal of what might be possible and then designing a prototype of it. It was very interesting to me that you say you promote that prototype. Does that mean you go public with the prototype before you have the total present for the community, as you say, the end project?
Well, you know, the spiral, the path is a model. And every situation obviously is different. And so this model will be calibrated for different situations. And sometimes you would present it and then prototype it. So those last three steps can be switched around. The first three steps are pretty clear, but depending on the circumstances, you might want to rearrange the last three steps. It's important that we know that it's a model to be calibrated to different situations.
Right. Because I just sort of figured prototypes are usually not promoted so much until they're tried out. Mm-hmm. At least that was my association with the word, but then you know a lot more about this than I do.
Well, the prototype can actually be part of the promotion. One project my students did, they wanted to have these gorilla planters on streets, and they just did it. And that was the prototype. And each of the prototypes had a little plaque on it explaining the intent of the project. So it promoted at the same time that it prototyped.
What kind of plantings in Salt Lake City did they put in those gorilla planters?
They put in cabbage. And I think petunias to add some color.
Petunias.
And they just had they built these large planter boxes and put them on corners in areas of the downtown that didn't have any vegetation.
Oh, I'm thinking native plants like bromeliads, but... Anyway, okay, they're learning and they're in school. Okay, so now that we see what your system of these six steps is, can you compare that with the usual way urban redesign or design is approached by firms that are hired by municipal governments to redo some section?
Well, typically people start with a problem. You know, you're given a challenge. Here's your problem, and you're supposed to resolve it. So they go from problem, and they find out all about the problem, and then they go directly from problem to solution, which is actually the third step proposed. And this approach says, keep your problem in mind. Don't forget about it, but take a pause. So you go problem and then pause and then prospect. And then you spiral up to propose, and by the time you get to propose, you look back at your problem. And the difference now is that you've prospected for the gifts, you've identified the assets in an area, you've also built community among stakeholders, because the first step, prospect, actually has three parts to it. And the first part is me search, when you say, what do I think should happen here? Which is very important. It's very important to get that out to yourself, because otherwise, if you don't, you might try to control the process.
Mm-hmm.
And also because you might have really good ideas that you don't want to lose. The second part of prospect is we search, where you ask others what they think, and then you do the research, which is gathering that data that New York Center and others do. So that's part of the process. Those are all part of prospect. So you're gathering all this information in that stage. By the time you get to propose this time, the problem is now looking like an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution, the proposal that you'll come up with, will be very different than the approach where you go directly from problem to propose. At this point, if you follow the path toward prosperity, your proposal will take the problem and turn it into a kind of blessing in disguise. Say, wow, what an incredible opportunity we have. And there are many examples where we see this being done now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems... I thought all the way through the book that your approach is what I'd call people rich. I mean, it really brings in the richness of community experience into the process of thinking about how should we correct a problem. And I also noticed that in the beginning you said this new approach is drawing on recent developments in organizational development and other areas, psychology. And I thought of that one new kind of organizational development where instead of going in and talking about, say, someone's hired to go into a business and fix some problematic situation, instead of going in and saying, okay, we're going to have a meeting of everybody in the room. Tell me what's wrong. I'm going to make a list here on the board of everything you say is wrong that we need to fix. Instead of doing that, the new approach is starting with, okay, everyone in the room, tell me what you really like about the way things work here.
Mm-hmm.
And you start, as you say, by identifying the gifts. And then from that, which sets a grounding, you know, that we have a positive grounding here to work with, and we're going to go forward and fix the things that aren't as good as what we're naming now. It just seemed there was the flavor of that, and I saw such a contrast with the technological version at the center at NYU, where they say, we get the data, and then we tell the people the data. We communicate the data to the people.
Which is
so different from having the community say,
yes,
you know, wow, we have a problem here. You know, mm-hmm. we're using so much energy in these buildings, and I would add, and we need to figure out ways to be cooling them naturally, and I hope bringing some trees into our streets. So just the community involvement in the way you do it, I thought was a real addition to the process.
Well, we've been talking about community engagement forever in urban planning, so some people might be listening and say, oh, we've been doing that all along. And we have, this is a kind of refinement of that. Sometimes, many times, community engagement is required by municipalities or other clients, and the consultant who's doing it will go through the motions, but it won't really be meaningful community engagement. And they often even will call it CYB, community engagement, cover your butt, community engagement, say,
yeah,
it.
I was just going to bring that really up. They pretend they're having, oh, tell us what you want, and then disregard it.
Either they disregard it or they don't give the people enough information to really give informed feedback, or
uh-huh.
they don't do it thoroughly enough. And many people will say, well, you know, we'd love to do it, but it takes so much time, and we don't have that kind of time. This method shows that it's such a good investment early on that you're saving a lot of time later. And not only that, many times when you skip it or you do the CYB version, you lose interest along the way, and
right.
you end up not having the support to realize the project.
Right.
What happens when you do it this way, when you follow the path toward prosperity, is that you're implementing it from the very beginning. The old approach, the conventional approach, says, let's come up with an idea, and then we'll implement it. This approach understands that coming up with the idea is already the beginning of the implementation. It's already
right.
the beginning, because as you're envisioning with other people, you're also rallying resources to realize that vision, because people will say, oh, wait a minute, I know a pot of money over here, or I can contribute my labor, or we have other people who can work on this.
Right, or
and
expertise,
it starts
right.
to happen in an organic way.
Mm-hmm. But what happens to those firms who, as you say, if they just kind of blow off the public wisdom and then they don't really get to the fulfillment of the project at the level that the city would like? I mean, they've already been paid, right? Is there a disincentive for them to work in that kind of disregarding the public way, other than reputation? I mean, I get it that a firm that's working more in the way you're talking about could say, look at the user satisfaction after this. You know, we succeed because we know how to really listen and work with communities. Or at that point, did they just say to the city, well, you know, this is the best anybody could have done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, do they lose any money by not working with people and not succeeding at the project as fully?
Not that time, but they might not get jobs in the future. Or
yeah,
there might
reputation.
Be a way that the city pulls the project.
Okay.
Because they're getting a lot of complaints from people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we have to pause here for the break, and when we come back, we'll hear about some concrete examples of how this works. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, and I'm speaking with my guest, Nan Ellen.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Nan Ellen, about her book, Good Urbanism. Well, I, having no credentials whatsoever in urban planning, actually wrote a whole chapter on community design and architecture for my last book, Relational Reality, even though I'm merely an eco-social dreamer, I was pulling together examples of what cities have done. So I just created a little flyover view of this town and told about what they'd done to change their built environment. But because of that exercise, I'm always really glad to learn about more creative thinkers in the field who are really helping society transform our cities. So, Nan, what are some examples of how your system has worked, your path?
I think the most well-known example is the High Line in New York. And that was an abandoned elevated rail corridor on the Lower West Side of New York. And many people were saying, it's a liability, it's bringing down property values, we should tear it down. And that was the conventional approach. Problem, solution. Solutions to tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
Another group of people joined together, and they followed this path, and they said, wait a minute, we've got tremendous assets here. We've got incredible people. We've got all these great neighborhoods. We've got lots of creative ideas for things to do with this. Let's connect the dots between all these assets, and let's make a proposal for this High Line. And they produced, they were inspired by the Promenade Santé in Paris, where they had done something similar.
Hmm.
And now it's a huge, huge amenity, and people visit from all over the world, this elevated parkway, this greenway through Manhattan, and it's now inspiring many others.
It's a walkway.
It's a walkway. It's a park.
Right. And the plantings along the border, I think, are beautiful. The firm that did that, I think, did a great job.
Yes, James Corner Field Operations did that, and they were inspired by wildflowers and local plantings. And they retained the old tracks, which is really wonderful. It adds some authenticity to it, and it doesn't feel too manicured. And I think people like that wildscape.
Yeah. Yeah,
and there
really
are lots of other, many other examples in Providence, Rhode Island. There used to be a highway that separated the town side of Providence from the Gown, which is where Brown University and Rhode Island School of Design were.
Mm-hmm.
And that highway was actually placed on top of a river.
Hmm.
And people got together and said, we want our river back.
Uh-huh.
And billions of dollars later, the highway was removed. And this, what was a wall, the highway created a wall between the town and the Gown, became now a porous membrane and a place where people gathered. And they converted it into a very large public art piece designed by Barnaby Evans called Waterfire, where they have fires, little bonfires in the evenings, and they have water, they have music piped in, 5 hours of world music, and they have performing arts, and people from the town and Gown gather there, and it's free, and it's fabulous, and it's, everything around there has become revitalized. So that's another really good example of good urbanism, and the project
there. Yeah, there have been a number of examples of uncovering streams and rivers. And,
daylighting. Mm-hmm.
I remember after the San Francisco earthquake, which I guess was in 1989 or so, a number of the streets where the buildings really just collapsed down toward the bay in the marina area of San Francisco were built on the old creek beds that ran down from the hills into the bay. And so, you know, I was thinking, oh, this is the perfect opportunity to restore those creeks.
Yeah.
As they'd done in Berkeley. They uncovered a creek in the center of Berkeley. It's beautiful now with the riparian habitat. But they didn't. The property owners just put the apartment buildings, two-story apartment buildings, back up on all those little streets. So,
but when you prospect for the gifts that are already there, you identify those wonderful things that are already there. And you protect them, and that's the first step. The conventional approach would typically add something at the expense of what was already there because they skip the prospecting. When you do the prospecting, the first step then becomes, let's protect everything that we love. And then you start saying, well, there's some things that we would really love, if only. And those are things that need some minor adjustments. And that's the second part. And then after you've protected what you love and you enhance what's underperforming, then you add what you don't have, and when you're adding, you don't add it at the expense of what's there. You build on what's there. And It's a really simple shift, but it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, well, it goes up against that assumption of modernity that every technological construction, you know, starts with just dumb matter, dumb material.
Yes.
And so, as you say, it's like a tabula rasa, and then we build. So it's entirely different to take a look at the value of, as you say, what's there and protect that and work with it.
The other thing that happens when you do that is that each place becomes very unique. You're revealing what's true and authentic to that place, whether it's the natural elements or the communities that are there. Instead of, you know, we always bemoan the fact that places around the world are appearing more and more alike.
Yeah.
This approach protects that spark of uniqueness of each place.
So can you give us some more examples?
The example of the project that I really learned this process from was Canalscape, and that's a project in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been living there for several years already, and I used to walk along these canals. And one day I just did my little me search, and I said, what should happen on these canals?
Are they empty? Or are they dry? Or they have water?
No, they're full of water. They're the water delivery system for the city.
Oh.
That's where the water comes from. And years ago...
Where does it come from, the Colorado or groundwater or where?
It comes from the Rio Salado watershed.
Oh.
And we actually have a separate system of canals that comes from the Colorado River.
Uh-huh.
But this system of canals that runs through the city comes from three different rivers.
Uh-huh. So they're coming down from the mountains?
Coming down from the mountains from the northeast to the southwest. That's how all of the water system runs. And as you mentioned, they were built originally by the Native Americans. The Native Americans disappeared for a while, and then the area was re-inhabited by white settlers who arrived, and they discovered the canals, and they started to recreate the canals. And originally, in the 19th century, people lived along the canals, just as the Native Americans had. But then that shifted with air conditioning, with suburban tract development, and the alleys became the canals became like back alleys of the city instead of front porches.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think, Phoenix has this incredible opportunity to become a canal city like Amsterdam or Venice, but we simply don't leverage this amazing asset that's here, this gift that's in our midst. So I came home and I wrote this little article and I sent it to the paper and they published it the next day.
Uh-huh.
And I got huge feedback from people of all ages and people in different professions saying, wow, we need to do this.
Oh.
And then I moved on and I said, well, I can't do this alone. I need to work with others. So I started the research part and I gathered 40 students together and we started working on it. And then we did the research, and we did the proposal, and we did the promote and prototype, and then we finally presented it. And so now it's been presented to the city of Phoenix and to different civic groups who are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the idea, basically, it's not to urbanize the canals like you might see in Amsterdam or Venice. It's to just take the places where the canals meet the major arterials and to convert them into vital urban hubs so people could live on the water, work on the water, have schools there. So we would really recognize these canals and bring them into our everyday lives. And people could start to visit Phoenix and have a canal experience just like they do in Amsterdam or Venice.
They also have trees along the canals and a lot of those streets, which are so beautiful in Amsterdam. But in these canals in Phoenix, so they're carrying the public drinking water. Do they have big fences to keep people from throwing things in the water, or how does that work?
No, they go to water treatment plants. So the actual right-of-ways along the canals are public, and people can walk there. And in some areas are very beautiful, but a lot of areas are dangerous and crime-ridden, and this would make them safer, just as Jane Jacobs talked about eyes on the street. This would put eyes on the canals.
Make it a focal point. Right. in the civic mosaic there. Well, yeah. We have time for a couple more short ones. How about some other examples?
Well, another example is Austin, Texas, mm-hmm. and this one's not actually in the book, but many people know about the bat festivals in Austin, Texas, and the celebrations of bats they have. Well, originally they saw that as that's because they pursued the path toward prosperity, and they have this wonderful civic urban event now. But before they did that, they did not follow the path toward prosperity. And they followed the conventional approach, and they said, we have a bat problem. We need a solution to the bat problem. And so the solution they came up with was to burn the bats. So not only did they have horrible odors, they were killing the poor little bats.
And more insects then in the town. Yeah, go ahead.
All the problems that that leads to. And then they realized, wait a minute, the bats are an asset. Let's create bat habitats and have bat festivals. And it's become a wonderful thing where nature and urbanism and people all come together.
And there's so many in the book here. Just you can pick any you'd like here. I wanted to give a few more examples.
Sure. Well, another example is the project that we have here in Utah called Envision Utah. And that is a project that really is a great example of collective envisioning and promoting. And
is that statewide?
It's statewide. It's based in Salt Lake City, but it is all over the state. And, in fact, other states are even coming to Envision Utah now as well. And it's been doing this for a while. It's been doing that kind of community engagement that people have been trying to do but haven't done so well. And they've done an excellent job, mainly because they've honored the communities and really been out there doing huge numbers of focus groups. They've done taken out the public service announcements on television sections and newspapers, and they've taken it very seriously instead of saying, oh, it's just one little piece that we just need to get over with. And so they've become a great example of successful collective envisioning, and that's why Utah's been really successful in getting things like public transit green infrastructure and other things, is that we've had this great collective envisioning process.
We had Peter Warshaw on the program in late December, and he was talking about his work with the Dreaming New Mexico Project. Are you familiar with their work?
No.
Oh, they've got a great website you might want to take a look at.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really looked at so many different aspects of the economic and different farming projects, and very interesting. So,
you know,
since you meet there
so
at the Four Corners
now.
Area, you're sort of
right. Yes,
you know, close neighbors.
Well, what's interesting is that once you start to understand this process, you start to see, you know, as you've described in your work on the relational shift, you start to see this everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's becoming much more of the norm than the exception.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say, people say that green was the new black, and indeed, along with sustainability efforts, it has been about making money, sustainability. But I like to say that now gold is the new green, this prospecting for the gold nuggets, this gold that's already there. And I think this desire comes from young people growing up in places that they feel are these sort of clone towns, places that look like everywhere.
Yeah.
And this huge sort of, just this huge desire to create authentic places, or to live in, just to live in authentic places.
Yeah, it's very hard for them to feel grounded in place if it's just, as you say, a modern cookie-cutter habitat. Well, we have about a minute left, and I'm interested in hearing about this concept in the book, Sideways Urbanism, Rotating the Pyramid.
Right. Well, most urbanism is top-down. People on the top decide what's going to happen. In the 60s, there was a lot of change in that regard, and people saying, you know, we want to have a say, and popular movements arose. And that was a kind of bottom-up urbanism. And so today we actually have both. We have top-down, and then we have grassroots movements coming along saying this is what we think should happen. And what sideways urbanism does is it tips the pyramid, it rotates it onto its side, and it says we need to do top-down and bottom-up at the same time and have mm-hmm. everybody involved from the beginning. So you can mm-hmm. be anyone. You can be a community member. You can be a politician, you can be a developer, you can be an urban planner. Doesn't matter who you are, you can start a project. Mm-hmm. But as soon as possible, you want to draw in all these other stakeholders as quickly as possible, and everybody works together and moves along from the wide end of the triangle on the left to the top of the triangle, the point on the right. And by that time, you've already sort of rallied your resources to realize that vision, and it's starting to happen. So it's basically combining top-down and bottom-up urbanism. And another way of describing that is co-creation. And uh-huh. everybody well, can contribute.
Yeah, everyone working together from different directions, yeah. So folks, listen up. If you're out there and there's some area in your town or city that's going to get attention soon, you really want to take a look at this book, Good Urbanism, because it has so many wise suggestions and proven methods for how this can be a richer experience with a richer outcome for your town or city. So that's all the time we have. But Nan Ellen, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's go over to the Arts Corner, see what we have this week. I figured that since we've been talking with Nan Ellen today in Utah, we'll hear a poem from a neighboring state. Linda Hogan is a Native American poet, essayist, and novelist. She taught creative writing and ethnic studies for many years at the University of Colorado, and she's currently the writer-in-residence of the Chickasaw Nation. Among her works is the terrific novel, Solar Storms, as well as the collection of essays, Dwellings, A Spiritual History of the World, and the novel Power, plus many volumes of poetry. Linda Hogan has received a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Lannan Award, the Colorado Book Award, and many others. This poem is from her collection entitled The Book of Medicines. The poem is Map. This is the world, so vast and lonely, without end, with mountains named for men who brought hunger from other lands, and fear of the thick, dark forest of trees that held each other up, knowing fire dreamed of swallowing them and spoke an older tongue. And the tongue of the nation of wolves was the wind around them. Even ice was not silent. It cried its broken self back to warmth. But they called it ice, wolf, forest of sticks, as if words would make it something they could hold in gloved hands, open, plot away, and follow. This is the map of the forsaken world. This is the world without end, where forests have been cut away from their trees. These are the lines wolf could not pass over. This is what I know from science, that a grain of dust dwells at the center of every flake of snow, that ice can have its way with land, that wolves live inside a circle of their own beginning. This is what I know from blood. The first language is not our own. There are names each thing has for itself, and beneath us the other order already moves. It is burning, it is dreaming, it is waking up. For our song today, we'll hear a Diné, or Navajo, healing song.
Hamaholoko, a yo, John Nico,
A Dine healing song. Here's another Dine blessing, the beauty way. May it be beautiful. May it be beautiful before you. May it be beautiful behind you. May it be beautiful to the left of you. May it be beautiful to the right of you. May it be beautiful above you. May it be beautiful beneath you. May it be beautiful inside you. May it be beautiful all around you. In beauty, it is ended. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guest will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week for our International Women's Day program when my guest will be Barbara Shaw, who is a wise expert in the field of violence prevention. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.